From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden. This Tuesday marks the 10-year anniversary of the American invasion of Iraq. It's been a challenging time for Iraqis living with the everyday chaos and violence, and for soldiers living with the physical and psychological consequences of the war.
Trying to reconcile what I had just done, destroying this family, with what our mission was. You know, they're in direct contrast with each other.
And Stephen Hadley, senior national security advisor to former President George W. Bush, describes how his White House similarly had to reconcile with their choices in Iraq.
Clearly, the situation got away from us.
Then, on a lighter note, I speak with the hat designer, Philip Tracy, the man responsible for all those wild head toppers at Will and Kate's royal wedding.
When people come and visit me and have a hat made, it's a little bit like visiting a psychiatrist, but they don't actually realize that.
I guess it's what's on top of your head that counts. And then it's time to crack open a cold one. But wait, maybe that fancy brew you're drinking isn't as handcrafted as you may think.
Big beer, when I say big beer, I mean Anheuser-Busch InBev and MillerCoors currently have 90% of the market.
It's the battle of the beers. Plus, country music has a new sweetheart in singer-songwriter Kacey Musgraves. Her new CD is called Same Trailer, Different Park, comes out this week, and she joins me to talk about small-town life and lyrics. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Years ago, on Tuesday, the U.S. invaded Iraq.
The cruise missiles are raining down on Baghdad.
The edifice of the man responsible for two decades of tyranny pulled down.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended.
U.S. and Iraqi forces continued their lightning sweep into Fallujah.
They queued to vote. Women in one line.
The rest of our troops in Iraq will come home by the end of the year.
By any count, and there have been many, the toll has been devastating. In blood, about 4,400 U.S. troops and more than 100,000 Iraqi civilians dead. And in treasure, combined costs of the war come to an astounding $2 trillion. A new report out of Brown University finds that includes future commitments like veteran care. Our cover story today, the Iraq War, where we stand 10 years later. Even though the war officially ended in December of 2011, there are those who still live with its legacy and always will. Shannon Meehan is a veteran living in suburban Philadelphia with his wife and three young sons. Back in 2007, Meehan was 24 years old and a tank platoon leader in the city of Bakuba. He was on a control mission, traveling house to house, making sure they were clear.
My soldiers came upon one house in particular that basically appeared to be booby-trapped to us. And I called in a mortar strike and what I thought was an effort to protect the lives of my soldiers. And mortar rounds were fired and etched through the sky, making their way to this house. And as they came in, they destroyed the target. They destroyed the house. And first, I remember feeling this sense of relief. However, that feeling quickly changed when we received word that there was an innocent family inside that house. There was a mother and father and their children huddled inside that house that I had just destroyed. And trying to reconcile what I had just done, destroying this family, with what our mission was, you know, they're in direct contrast with each other. And I was just overwhelmed with a sense of disbelief and guilt immediately.
I'm wondering how it is that you live or cope with the image of what happened to the family.
Honestly, it's terribly difficult. It's something that I struggle with almost every day. And I remember having our first child. And certainly every parent or to-be parent feels a great deal of weight upon them. But I just felt like it was different. I was bringing into this world this beautiful gift that I had robbed another father of. this beautiful gift that I myself had destroyed. So there was this heaviness surrounding that.
Also in 2007, Shannon Meehan stepped on a tripwire and was thrown skyward in an IED blast. He suffered from a ruptured eardrum, shrapnel wounds, and traumatic brain injury. He was awarded the Purple Heart for his wounds, but says he struggled to take pride in the medal.
I just can't help but think of that family. You know, their deaths will go unhonored, and they'll soon be forgotten. And there's nothing that's going to change that, yet I am sitting here with a medal for my injuries, which are far less than anything of what that family had felt.
Meehan says he's fearful about how this war will be remembered.
That it'll be remembered as the mistake war, the war that we shouldn't have been in, or the illegal war. And to hear that our efforts and the deaths of our friends will go down as nothing more than a mistake is damning.
That's Shannon Meehan, a retired Army captain, living with traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder, which have come to be known as the signature injuries of the Iraq War. Meehan's written about his experiences in a memoir, Beyond Duty. 6,000 miles away in Baghdad lives 37-year-old Ayman Salehi. Like Meehan, he's the father to young boys, and he's coping with a shattered life.
In 2005, I lost my brother Yasser by mistake, by one of the American snipers shot him in one of the Baghdad districts.
Salehi's brother Yasser was driving for a haircut one morning when he made a wrong turn onto a street that had been cleared by the American soldiers.
And suddenly, he faced two American soldiers, one of them shot in the front of his car, and the second directly shot him in his head.
Salehi's brother Yasser was my own translator when I reported from Iraq, and later, in 2006, NPR did an investigative story on the shooting. Ayman Salehi lives with it every day.
I miss him. I'm thinking of him all the time. Yasser means a lot for me.
The time has passed, and Ayman Salehi is married and is working as a civil engineer. He's pessimistic about Iraq's future.
It's not good. It's not better. And this time, it makes no difference between Saddam regime and now.
It's really striking to contemplate how invisible the American footprint has become here.
Ernesto Londoño is a Washington Post Pentagon correspondent now in Baghdad covering the anniversary. About $60 billion in American taxpayer funds have gone toward the rebuilding of Iraq. But a recent Inspector General's report to Congress says the results simply don't show it.
You look around at the neighborhoods where Americans invested a lot of money, and there's really very little that is visible.
Londoño was in Baghdad in 2007 at the peak of the sectarian violence. Today, he says, if you're one of the lucky few, the picture's better.
Some people are doing very well. You see a surprising amount of wealth out on the street. You see it in the cars people drive. You see it in the shops that have opened. You see it in the little shopping malls that you're starting to see in some of the more affluent parts of the city. Iraqis are more plugged in digitally than they've ever been, obviously. This used to be a hugely repressed society that was essentially cut out from the world. And now, you know, Iraqis have one, two cell phones. Everybody's on Facebook.
But sectarian tension is still evident, especially at the political level.
You have a government dominated by Shias that many Sunnis accuse of being authoritarian, of using its security apparatus to marginalize them, to crack down on them. At the street level, however, things have changed dramatically. I think at the end of the sectarian war here in 2008, there came a point where people realized that they were being set up by hardline groups, by the militias, by the insurgency, and that they were sort of being foolishly pushed into this really brutal fight. But, you know, the war definitely left scars. The neighborhoods that were mixed before are nowhere nearly as mixed now.
The Washington Post, Ernesto Londoño. Stephen Hadley was part of the White House team that helped sell the war to the public. He then served as the National Security Advisor to President George W. Bush from 2005 to 2009. Hadley sat down with me this week to talk about the anniversary. I asked him whether citing Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction as a reason for invading Iraq was a mistake.
Well, clearly he did not have the stocks of weapons of mass destruction that the intelligence community, not only in this country but other countries as well, thought. And Republicans thought he had them. Democrats thought he had them. The Clinton administration thought he had them. The Bush administration thought he had them. We were all wrong. Second, obviously, the invasion initially was very successful, but what followed took longer and was paid enormous costs in terms of money and lives, both American and Iraqi. But I think the central judgment that this was a man who was a national security threat to the region and to us here at home was true. And if you think about what Iran is doing in terms of pursuing nuclear weapons, you can bet Saddam Hussein would not have been left behind.
In a 2010 Wall Street Journal op-ed, you wrote that we met our objectives to leave behind an Iraq that would be able to govern itself, sustain itself, and be an ally in the war on terror. That was almost 3 years ago. Do you still believe that to be true?
I do. I think we met our narrow national security objectives. This is a regime that is not supporting terror, is not invading its neighbors, is not pursuing weapons of mass destruction, and is not brutalizing its people. Then the question was, could we leave a regime that could defend itself, govern itself, sustain itself, and be an ally in the war on terror? I think it has. There are no American troops there today. And it does govern itself economically. It is doing better. It is functioning, and it is opposing terror, not supporting terror. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. Is there still sectarian violence? Absolutely. But part of the reason is the neighborhood, and particularly the war in Syria, is putting enormous pressure on Iraq today.
Well, isn't one of the requisites of a sovereign country that it can protect its borders? Do you think that you've left behind an Iraq that really can do that? You just mentioned Syria.
I think actually it can. There has been Iraqi activity on the Syrian border to try to seal that border. Iraq still, while it has a pretty formidable army, it still does not have the kind of air force that would be required. But I think this is a country actually that is taking responsibility for its own security, both internally and externally.
Let me ask you, please, about some of the human toll on both sides, because whatever objectives were met, it certainly came at tremendous cost.
And no question about that.
Was it what had been anticipated?
Clearly, it was not what was anticipated. Clearly, the situation got away from us in 2004, 2005, and 2006. And the cost of getting it back under control as a result of the surge decision was too high in terms of dollars, in terms of lives of Americans, in terms of lives of Iraqis. It's one of the reasons some of us have been arguing that we need to do something to bring the war in Syria to a close.
Stephen Hadley sees the possibility of a return to sectarian war in Iraq. Find out why as I continue my conversation with the former National Security Advisor in just a few minutes. Reflect on the 10-year anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, a continuation of my conversation with a close member of then-President George W. Bush's team, former National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley. In 2006, a memo Hadley wrote for cabinet-level officials caused waves when it was leaked to the press. At the time, Iraq had imploded in a wave of sectarian violence. In that memo, Hadley expressed concerns about Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's willingness to resolve those sectarian fissures. In my conversation with Stephen Hadley, I asked him if Prime Minister Maliki now is the sort of partner that the U.S. had envisioned, and whether Iraq is truly an ally in the war on terror.
The memo was in 2006 when the president was trying to contemplate whether he should surge American forces and change our strategy. And the question was, is Maliki really a sectarian, or is he committed to an inclusive Iraq? Mm-hmm. And if he is, then why aren't we seeing it on the ground? Is it because he doesn't have the power to impose that kind of agenda, or that he doesn't really know what's going on? What's with this person? And I was sent over to try to get an initial take and to ask the kinds of questions that the president himself would have to answer about Maliki before he made the decision on the surge. And so the process of preparing the surge, which is a change of strategy and increasing our forces there, had a number of tests that Maliki had to pass, would he say publicly to his country that he supported the surge and that it was going to be cross-sectarian? Would Iraqi forces participate in the surge? All these things that were a test as to whether Maliki would be a cross-sectarian and inclusive leader. And the president concluded that Maliki would play that role. And at the end of the day, we had the surge, and it succeeded. Maliki has a lot of challenges. He's an imperfect leader. But I think he met the test that was set out in that memo. And the president was confident that Maliki would be a partner in the surge that ultimately brought an end to hostilities in Iraq and allowed U.S. troops to leave.
But many Sunnis call him a dictator.
They do. We tried very hard in 2007 and 2008 to have a government of national unity in which Sunni, Kurds, and Shia would all participate. And a bargain was struck. And I think it was imperfect, but pretty good in 2007, 2008. Unfortunately, what we're seeing today is that bargain is fraying. And it's fraying really for two reasons. One, the United States left completely in 2011, did not leave a residual force, and quite frankly, has not paid attention to Iraq. And I'll give you one example.
But part of that was Maliki's decision as well.
He did. It was a decision, but the withdrawal was occurred pursuant to an agreement that actually President Bush negotiated. And the understanding was we'll look at the end of 2011, and if it looks like more forces are required, we can negotiate something at that time. And the Obama administration tried to. For various reasons, it did not work. The consequence, of course, is that Maliki and Iraq does not have the kind of support from the United States it needs because it faces two problems: encroachment from Iran and a sectarian war in Syria that, when the largely Sunni opposition wins, the concern Maliki has is that that Sunni opposition will say, well, if we toppled Assad, let's topple Maliki. And civil war or civil sectarian war, if you will, returns to Iraq.
And you see that as a possibility?
I see that as a possibility, which is why a number of us have been saying we need to move more quickly to bring the war in Syria. So the basic deal we had, I think, is under stress. It's under stress from Iran. It's under stress from Syria. And the United States is not playing the role it needs to play in terms of helping Iraq get through this very difficult transition period.
That's Stephen Hadley. He's the former National Security Advisor under President George W. Bush, now Senior Advisor at the U.S. Institutes of Peace. Thank you very much for coming in.
Nice to be here.
This week, the Mormon Church released the most significant changes to their scripture in over three decades. We're joined now by Mormon scholar Terrell Givens to talk about these additions. Terrell Givens, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So this week, the Mormon Church releases this new digital edition of the four books of Church of the Latter-day Saints scriptures. And this is the first time since 1981 that the Church has revised them. What changes are being found in these new editions?
Well, the vast majority of the changes are very minor typographical, grammar, punctuation, and so forth. But there are some rather substantive changes in terms of the introductions to the actual scriptural material. And those are what are really catching the attention of members of the church.
Well, some of these changes deal with longstanding tenets that have been debated a lot in recent years. Let's take the one about the ordination of men of African American descent. What's going on there?
Well, it appears that Joseph Smith himself ordained black members of the church to the priesthood, but sometime after his death, beginning in the late 1840s, Brigham Young apparently charted a new direction in terms of the way that blacks were the place that they found in the church and began what became known as the ban, according to which people of African-American ancestry were not permitted to hold the priesthood or to participate in temple ordinances. And that was a policy that remained in place until 1978. It's really the albatross around the neck of the church, and it was for many, many years. I think that this new introduction to the revelation ending the priesthood ban is a major step forward in many ways because it acknowledges that the practice may have originated, it seems to me, this is how I'm reading it anyhow, as a matter of error or cultural and historical conditioning rather than as the will of God. And that's a fairly significant statement for the church to make.
So, Tara, what exactly is the precise language that says that this is a change?
Well, the revelation ending the ban on the priesthood is called Official Declaration 2, and it appears in the church's Doctrine and Covenants. And there was essentially no introductory notes prior to this week. Now there is a paragraph introducing the end of the ban that reads, "The Book of Mormon teaches that all are alike unto God, including black and white." Then it goes on to say that throughout the history of the church, people of every race and ethnicity have been baptized and lived as faithful members. It mentions that during Joseph Smith's lifetime, a few black male members of the church were ordained to the priesthood. But then it notes that early in its history, church leaders stopped conferring the priesthood on black males of African descent, and church records offer no clear insights into the origin of this practice.
There was another tradition which has been frowned upon in the church in modern times, and that is the practice of polygamy. I understand there was also some specific language with reference to monogamy in the changes.
Yeah, and I think that there are two really significant developments in terms of that introduction. In this case, the scripture that we're talking about is called Official Declaration 1, which is also appended to the end of the Book of Doctrine and Covenants. And the new introduction to this revelation, which ended officially the practice of plural marriage in 1890, begins by saying the Bible and the Book of Mormon teach that monogamy is God's standard for marriage, unless he declares otherwise. And I think one could read that almost as an inversion of many Mormons' historical understanding of plural marriage. For many years, it was taught that plural marriage represented a higher law, a law to which people could aspire if they were worthy and prepared for this higher law. Now that's been inverted to the point that monogamy is declared to be the standard law for God of marriage, and polygamy represents a brief and momentary historical aberration from that norm. That's a fairly significant change in focus.
You've been looking at Mormonism a long time. How is it evolving?
Well, I think that we're actually entering one of the most interesting periods of the modern Mormon church. In many ways, what we're seeing here with these changes is the privileging of history over theology in some ways. It's a kind of acknowledgement that the Mormon church is rooted in a past that is replete with historical claims. And it's a magnificent thing for a church to allow professional historians to have a lead role in the way that Scripture is presented and its story is told.
That's Terrell Givens. He's a professor of literature and religion at the University of Richmond, co-author of The God Who Weeps, How Mormonism Makes Sense of Life. Terrell Givens, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael McCann is a writer with Sports Illustrated. He's been covering what's probably the biggest story in sports in the last year, Lance Armstrong's fall from grace into a legal quagmire. McCann regularly responds to readers' questions on Twitter, and about a month ago, something very intriguing happened.
I noticed that at Lance Armstrong followed me on Twitter.
Now, McCann's thinking it can't be the Armstrong, right? Nevertheless, he began to exchange messages online. They never spoke by phone. Then 2 weeks ago, at Lance Armstrong invited McCann to come to Austin for an interview. If this were really Lance, it would be the only interview with Armstrong since the Oprah Winfrey appearance in January.
The whole time, my wife and other family members were a little bit skeptical that this was even real. Maybe this is a hoax. Maybe I'll go down there and it won't be him.
It really was Lance Armstrong, and they talked for 3 hours that day.
The only constraint I had is that I could not quote him directly on most topics, that I could paraphrase what he said. And of course, it limited how much I could reveal in terms of what he said.
So given all of that, how long did it last, and what did you learn that you hadn't known before?
The conversation lasted about 3 hours. And in terms of what I learned that I didn't know going in, I would say that he impressed me in terms of his willingness to talk about any topic. And I also learned some things that I didn't know. We talked, for instance, about the lawsuits that he brought against individuals that had basically said that he had doped, and he used litigation to counter those allegations. And we talked about why would he do that. He didn't blame his lawyers. He didn't blame his advisors. He did mention, however, that companies with which he had endorsement contracts had expected that he would respond aggressively to allegations. I would also say what I didn't know going in was that He's very much focused right now on litigation. His immediate short-term focus is on responding to a handful of lawsuits, which threaten him tremendously.
That's so interesting, Michael. I mean, because in the Oprah Winfrey interview, he came off really as fairly robotic. I just have to ask you, did he express regret at having misled the public for so many years, all the denials about the doping? Did he say, I'm so terribly, terribly sorry?
Yeah, he did. And he raised that specifically when I said, what about all your fans? What about the fans that you've lost because of this? And he definitely expressed contrition about those that believed in him and that now are extremely disappointed in him. And I felt that it was genuine. You know, I can't get inside someone's heart, but I believe that he genuinely is disappointed that he's disappointed so many people, including people that believed in him so firmly. He did argue that if you look at, for instance, all of the lying that he had, he was asked the question about doping much more often than other cyclists, that the media and the public awareness was focused on him and not others who he argues were doing the same things that he was doing. And I think that was a theme that he tried to raise, is that his achievements were extraordinary and his cheating was only ordinary. Now, again, that doesn't defend cheating, but at least gets inside his mind to say he was still the top racer in an era where, at least he argues, everyone was cheating. Whether that's true, you know, people are going back and forth on that. I've had people email me saying that's categorically untrue. I've had others contact me saying it was true. I'm not in a position where I can really evaluate that claim, but I am looking into it.
That's Michael McCann. He's a legal analyst and writer for Sports Illustrated, and he also directs the Sports and Entertainment Law Program at the University of New Hampshire School of Law. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
As we've seen, Sarah Jessica Parker, Lady Gaga, and Kate Middleton are simply mad for Philip Tracy's hats.
In 2011, Irish milliner Philip Tracy fascinated tens of millions who saw the 36 different hats he created on the heads of Kate Middleton and the royal wedding party. That's score one for Ireland this St. Patrick's Day weekend. Perhaps you'll recall Princess Beatrice's modernist spidery creation with its undulating tentacles. A royal wedding is a far cry from Philip Tracy's birthplace in County Galway, Ireland, in a rural village of about 500 people. Tracy's father was a baker, his mother a homemaker, and Philip Tracy was one of eight kids. Even the feathers from his mother's chickens made their way into his earliest designs.
I was just, as a child, very different from the others and didn't really care what they thought, because, you know, a child doesn't really have any inhibitions. So it's only you gain your inhibitions later. But mm-hmm. I was interested in everything that everybody else was not interested in.
You had a sewing machine, right?
Yes. My mother had a sewing machine that I was very much not allowed on and couldn't lift. But when she would feed our chickens at the end of the garden, when she would be like far up the garden, I'd sort of quickly get the machine out, stagger over to collect it, take it to a table, get it working. I just thought it was the most amazing thing that this little needle went up and down and stuck two pieces of material together. And I just thought it was my version of having an iPod.
When did your interest switch from working on clothes to hats? Was there a particular moment? I mean, you went to school at the National College of Art and Design in Dublin.
Yes. My career in hats started when I was a student at the National College of Art in Dublin. Mm-hmm. And I bought an old straw hat in a junk market and took it apart and remade what I thought a hat could look like. And I had a tutor at college and I said, oh, I've made a hat. And she said, well, can you bring it in? I'd like to see it. So I brought it in and she bought it. So I thought, that's a result. And so I haven't really stopped from there, really.
This book takes us through the early days, and you have a very small studio, and it sounds like a lot of fun. And then progressively, you know, you get into bigger buildings, although I love the pictures of, you know, how messy everything was. You have a house model who's always there for you to try things on. Would you walk me through a fitting? I mean, in my dreams, I'm walking into Philip Tracy's studio.
When people come and visit me and have a hat made, it's a little bit like visiting a psychiatrist, but they don't actually realize that. So I'm just really trying to learn from a brief conversation with them about just anything in general, how far they want to go, where they definitely don't want to go with their head or their hat. So generally, I am trying to make that person happy and feel good and look good for that ultimate occasion in their lives. Because in this part of the world where we come from, hats are part of, you know, ultimate occasions in one's life. And I've been lucky to be involved in those, from, you know, royal weddings, or, you know, when Madonna performed at the Super Bowl, I made that. So, you know, it is part of ultimate moments in people's lives. Hats are part of, you know, a global culture, because every culture all over the world has a history of hats, including America. I mean, America brought us the baseball cap.
Yes.
It's one of my favorite hats.
I like a baseball cap, but when you think back historically, people wore around the world a lot more fantastical headgear than many people wear today. I sometimes wonder why.
You know, hats have changed meaning. At one time, hats were a conformist accessory, when you conformed. Mm-hmm. And now they're an accessory of rebellion. So that's why young people are attracted to the quirkiness of a hat, because they like to be interested in something or wear something that their parents aren't interested in. I mean, if you look on TV, you know, all those kids on MTV, they've got, you know, hats of some description on, or ethnic communities in America, they wear hats. The policeman wears a hat, the fireman wears a hat, the waitress wears a hat sometimes. Hats are part of our lives. You know, they're not going to disappear or go away. As long as we have a head, there will always be hats of some description, because human beings have always decorated their heads in some way, whether it's a ribbon or a hairband or, you know, the way they do their hair. It's human nature. Otherwise, we'd look, you know, Neanderthal.
I'm speaking with Irish milliner Philip Tracy, whose haute couture fantastic hats are chronicled in a new book with photographer Kevin Davies. Can I ask you just a little bit about your relationship with the late designer Alexander McQueen?
Yes.
And I don't want to get into anything painful.
Sure.
When the late designer's retrospective was staged at the Metropolitan Museum, did you and Alexander have a similar vision, would you say?
Yes, we did. We worked together for all his career. He had a fearlessness about design and fashion that was admirable. And I have the same fearlessness about hats. It's very easy to look at one of my hats and think, who is this crazy person making this crazy hat? But I am trying to make elegant and beautiful hats. And so did he. Our angle was beauty, but modern beauty. And we live in the 21st century, or he lived, and I still live. And that's one's job is when one works in design and fashion today, because I should not be making 1950s hats, because we're not living in 1950, we're living in 2013. So I'm attracted to the future. I believe in the future. We need the future, otherwise we'd look the same.
I must talk about the future in the person of Kate Middleton and the royal wedding. You designed 36 hats for the wedding, and I think it's how a lot of Americans will know your work. What was that like for you as a designer?
It was one of the most exciting projects I've ever worked on, because usually I'm working for entertainers or designers, and there's an unreality to that, which is interesting, because it's the world of illusion. Whereas what was exciting about this event was it was real people, it wasn't models. And everybody was going to the same event, so it was like approaching a military operation, so that nobody wore the same hat, nobody had the same color, nobody had the same styling. And it was an infectious experience because everybody was very excited. It was the biggest, greatest show on earth that day.
I want to ask before we close, have you ever had the occasion to make a hat for your mother after all these years?
Well, my mum died 20 years ago, and the only person I never made a hat for, that's a very interesting question you asked, that was my mother, because my mother didn't really, she preferred to make her own hats. Hmm. Can you believe that?
Well, that's because it's a mother, you know? It just has to be something
yes,
like that.
Yes, she was quite, I mean, she was intrigued by everything, but she didn't want one of my hats. She made her own.
That's milliner Philip Tracy. His hats are the subject of a new book by photographer Kevin Davies. Be sure to check some of them out on our website at npr.org. And Philip, it has really been fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Americans love their beer. It's the world's most popular drink. But most of us know even less about the beer industry today than we do about how St. Patrick chased the snakes out of Ireland. So, belly up.
Refreshingly smooth, Bud Light.
Coors Light. It's Miller time.
Heineken. Sounds good.
That's our cover story, Big, Big Beer, and the sudsy fight to be America's draft. Beer. We drink enough fermented hops to consume more than $200 billion annually, and that's just here in the U.S. What you should know as you sip is that 90% of our domestic beer market is dominated by just two companies, Anheuser-Busch InBev and Miller Coors. But smaller brewmeisters are challenging that dominance. Craft beer, that is, smaller mom-and-pop-style breweries or regional breweries, now account for about 6% of domestic beer sales. Now, that might seem like a small number, but it's been growing every year since the early 1990s, while the big brewer share is declining. So let's begin by raising a glass at Meridian Pint, a trendy joint here in D.C., where you'd get run out of town if you tried to order a Coors. Brian Davis is a graduate student, and he's drinking a Nugget Nectar.
Really intense flavor. You know that you're supporting organizations that you care about, local economies.
You'll have a lot of choices in the future, too, now that there are more small breweries than there were before Prohibition, when beer was largely a regional business. And if you're really into beer, you can become a certified Cicerone. That's like a sommelier, only for beer. Sam Fritz is a Cicerone.
I try to have a nice mix of approachable craft beers as well as exciting new stuff for people who have tried a lot of the more everyday beers.
Sam Fritz is also the beer director for Meridian Pint, which also offers DC Brow, Flying Dog, and Oxbow Space Cowboy. He prides himself on offering this kind of hand-picked selection.
I do not carry any beers that come under the Miller or Coors or Bud labels.
That's just fine with his customers. Beer drinker Landon Wardham says he's not looking for those big names.
When I go out to a bar, I'm almost always looking for what haven't I tried before.
Last month, the Justice Department blocked an attempted merger between Anheuser-Busch InBev and the Mexican beer maker Grupo Modelo. Anheuser already owns 50% of the Mexican beer maker. Journalist Elizabeth Flock wrote about this and other trends recently in the beer market in U.S. News and World Report.
The Department of Justice has said that this merger would get rid of their competition. Anheuser-Busch is the biggest beer company in the world. Miller Coors is second, and Grupo Modelo is third. So if they were to buy Grupo Modelo, they would effectively get rid of their biggest competition that they could possibly own.
So, Elizabeth Flock, you've written that the market shares of the great big companies, Anheuser-Busch, InBev, is actually declining. Mm-hmm. What would a merger like that mean for the little craft breweries that we see? And how much of the market do they have?
So big beer, when I say big beer, I mean Anheuser-Busch, InBev, and Miller Coors currently have 90% of the market. And craft beer in the U.S. has 6%. And craft beer has said, even though they're new, they've only really been around since the 90s, that 6% is too small, a 90% is too big, and that big beer is increasingly trying to keep craft beer down, and that this merger would just be sort of another step for big beer to be able to keep craft beer out, keep independent beers off the shelves away from consumers.
And how are we defining a craft beer?
Big beer likes to say that craft beer is just a marketing term. Craft brewers, on the other hand, would contend that craft beers are small, independent, family-owned, and they say that craft beer cannot be more than 25% owned by a big beer company, and that it also cannot make more than 6 million barrels of beer a year.
Maybe just to compare, tell me how big the corporate beer makers, the big beer makers actually are.
So I know that Anheuser-Busch, with just 14 of their 200 brands, gets $1 billion a year in revenue. And so, you know, when you have 200 brands, that effectively can take over store shelves.
That's another area where these brewers compete, isn't it? Just on the shelf space.
Absolutely. I would say that this is the number one place where this battle between craft beer and big beer is sort of playing out, because everyone wants to be in grocery store shelves at eye level. When a consumer goes and is just sort of scanning, they want to be there. And craft brewers say that big beer is increasingly pushing them out of those prime spots at grocery stores, at bars, at sporting arenas, at airports. Anywhere you can find a beer, they say they're increasingly being pushed out.
So there's a couple of craft beers that you cite as being owned by huge companies. You call these crafty beers. What do you mean by that?
The Brewers Association, it's sort of a term that they use to knock big beer for calling it crafty beer. And, you know, one of the things that they're most upset about, the sort of deceptive tactics that they say big beer is using, is to present beers that they make, that Anheuser-Busch or MillerCoors make, as craft when they aren't. So a really good example of this is Blue Moon. Blue Moon is an enormously popular beer. You can find it anywhere. A lot of people think that it's a craft beer, but in fact is made by MillerCoors.
So Blue Moon, now owned by MillerCoors, how do they advertise? Do they switch their advertising for something like the crafty beer?
You increasingly see big beer companies trying to advertise to the kind of person, a hipster type, or someone who's really into, you know, sort of a distinctive beer.
In a borough that has it all, we've come to Park Slope, where there's culture around almost every corner. Today, in a converted garage turned rock club, we're parked for a burger, a beer, and to get to know a great band. Check it out on The Local Scene, presented by Blue Moon.
In terms of the market, does it matter? Are these small beers, the craft beers, are they really getting squeezed out?
What craft brewers would say to that is they would say what matters is that consumers aren't getting choice. So they might go to a bar and there might be eight beers on tap. And you might see that one is, you know, Bud Light and one is a so-called craft beer and then one is an import beer. It seems like there are eight different beers. But in fact, all of those beers could be made by Anheuser-Busch. So does it matter? Maybe not. Maybe you like all of those beers and you feel like you're getting a variety. But in fact, you're only getting a variety from one beer maker.
And also, the craft brewing trade, as it has blossomed from, I think your article said that at one time there were maybe just a couple hundred individual beer makers, but now there's more than a couple thousand.
That's right, yeah.
This has obviously created a lot of jobs, a lot of vitality in different parts of the country.
Yeah, absolutely. Although big beer would say that they create infinitely more jobs. And so to try to tamp down what they're doing would be to hurt the American economy, would get rid of jobs, and that craft beer just doesn't employ nearly as much.
Elizabeth Flock has reported on the beer industry for U.S. News and World Report. Crafty beer, though, might really be helping craft beer, says a 30-year veteran of the business. Benj Steinman is an editor for Beer Marketers Insights, a trade publication. The beers he's talking about are Blue Moon and Shock Top.
Some might say, well, what Anheuser-Busch and MillerCoors have done through Shock Top and Blue Moon is opened up a greater number of consumers to the universe of craft beers and their innovation, flavor, and variety. And they don't necessarily, you know, they're sort of gateway beers.
Gateway, meaning it's a more accessible craft beer. It might get you to start wanting to taste other things with notes of dark cherry or sassafras molasses. Julia Hers is the craft beer program director for the Brewers Association. She says big beer should print its names right on all its bottles.
What we've called for is a transparency of parent company ownership and to put that on the beer label so the beer lover has a chance to know who's behind those brands.
Hers says that branding matters to a lot of younger beer drinkers who are actually quite careful readers.
Many people care about the brands of what they consume and who owns those companies. And especially a lot of millennials are, you know, associating themselves with what they consume and what they hold in their hand.
Craft beers are without question, though, more expensive, which might make it harder for them to compete against the bigger brands.
This is a very middle class beverage. Working class beverage. So what a lot of people are looking for is what's affordable.
That's Chris Thorne. He's a spokesman for the Beer Institute, the largest beer industry trade group. He says that fierce competition is nothing new in this business. It's an American tradition.
When you look at the names of some of these breweries that we have today, whether it's Frederick Miller, whether it's Freddie Heineken waiting with off the shores of New York for Prohibition to end and come in, whether it's Adolf Coors, whether it's August Busch, these are names that are rooted in our heritage in the beer drinking culture in the United States, and they never got a break. They competed with each other.
And back at Meridian Pint, beer director Sam Fritz shows off his 24 beer taps, two dozen high-end brands. And he really doesn't want to lose his market share to beers pretending to be microbrews.
It certainly is more expensive. For what we're trying to do, we're trying to offer the highest quality products that we can, and that means buying from producers who use good ingredients and are innovative brewers.
But at the end of the day in the bar room, Landon Rorden says that even if he sampled some upscale microbrews at $6, $7, $8 a pint, he might go back down the ladder.
After I've had like 3 or 4 microbrews, I'll think, wow, that was $25, $30. I should probably get a Bud Light now because this is getting ridiculous, you know.
Then again, beer is for all occasions. Chances are that today, a lot of people are drinking green beer without much taste and enjoying every emerald drop.
Beer, 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 chimney beer, beer, beer.
A long time ago, way back in history, when all there was to drink was nothing but cups of tea, along came a man by the name of Charlie Mott, and he invented a wonderful drink.
You may already have heard of the young singer-songwriter Kacey Musgraves. She's getting a lot of buzz. The artistry in her haunting lyrics can be heard on the NBC television series Nashville. Now she has a debut album, same trailer, different park. It comes out next week.
You sure look real pretty in your glass house. You probably think it's too good to take the trash out.
Kacey Musgraves is joining us from Nashville, Tennessee. Kacey, I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Talk about being a singer when you're just beginning to find your way in this tiny town, Golden, Texas.
Well, so I grew up in Golden, and it's super small. There's nothing really there. There's like one little store. So I went to high school just outside of that in a town called Mineola, and it was a little bigger. It was about 5,000 or 6,000 people. I was the girl who sang growing up, you know, just pretty much anywhere in public that I could.
Here we get a sense of place in this single, Merry-Go-Round.
If you ain't got two kids by 21, you're probably gonna die alone. At least that's what tradition told you. And it don't matter if you don't believe. Come Sunday morning, you best be there in the front row like you're supposed to.
You know, what really speaks to me in those lines, if you ain't got two kids by 21, would have applied to a lot of people I went to high school with. And in Merry-Go-Round, you know, you've taken a little heat for some of these kinds of lines because it doesn't paint the iconic picture of small-town life. And in fact, there's a certain point of view that says it was an anti-country music song. Did you see it that way?
I mean, I had one guy, I think, on the radio tour say, this is the anti-country song. And I had to say, I'm sorry, no, it's just the anti-small mind song, anti-settling. But yeah, I'm all about small towns. I really am. I think it's a great place to grow up. But I think it might be a little more comforting to some people to hear it from a real perspective instead of one that tries to sweep things under the rug.
Mary, Mary, quack and trail.
So I am really wondering who you're channeling for this writing. I know you got some great teaching in your earlier years, but you seem like such a natural writer.
Thank you. Well, I hope that's because I love it so much. Yeah, I did have some early influences that pushed me to write and stick with it. And then once I kind of wrapped my brain around the whole process and creating a song and what all goes into that, I fell in love with it. It's like putting a puzzle together.
You know, your wordplay is so sophisticated. Let's listen to a little bit of Silver Lining, and then I want to ask you about songwriting. Your parents are still, are they anywhere living near Golden still?
They are. They're actually, yes.
They're there. Now, they run a printing shop. I just was wondering if that gave you a sense of being surrounded by words at all?
Yeah, for sure. They were always conjuring up some sort of wordplay or visual something. I mean, they're super creative.
So you moved from Golden to Austin when you were only 18 years old, and not very long after that, you moved to Nashville mm-hmm. to record your first record deal. Music Row, very different parts of the South. What was running through your mind as that was going on? I mean, here you are, and you're in, it's often called Nash Vegas.
It felt good. It was a little, you know, daunting, of course, moving away, but I really wanted to immerse myself in the songwriting community, and I knew that there was one here that was pretty unparalleled. So with some encouragement from a couple people that I knew here, Rodney Foster was one of them. Mm-hmm. He is somebody I sang backup for a while, and he basically just told me that you got to be present to win, and that really made a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. So you've written a couple of songs for the ABC show Nashville, including the song Undermine, which was featured prominently in one episode. Let's listen a little bit to Undermine.
And if I only had one shot, won't waste it on a shadow box, I stand right here.
Okay, follow me, Travis.
And it's all talk, 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 talking in the wind. It only slows you down if you start listening. And it's a whole lot harder.
So you've written songs for TV, for other country music stars, and you said a moment ago that you really enjoyed being a lyricist, but you seem to be making quite a name for yourself as a performer. How, you know, you've been on tour. In your head, what do you think of yourself as being?
Well, I mean, there's definitely both there, but I don't think you can really have one without the other. If I had to ultimately choose, I'd probably choose songwriting.
Let's talk about another track on this record. This one's called Follow Your Arrow.
Just cause you can't beat up, I mean you should join them. So make lots of noise, kiss lots of boys, kiss lots of girls. If that's something you're into, when the straight and narrow gets a little too straight, roll up the joint or don't. Just follow.
About these lyrics, Casey, what's the story behind them? You got kiss lots of boys, kiss lots of girls, if that's what you're into, roll up a mm-hmm. joint. And I'm just sitting here thinking, wow, this is a long way from, you know, Okie from Muskogee. Maybe country music's a bigger tent than I thought. What's going on here?
Really, Follow Your Arrow is just a song about living the way you want to live, loving who you want to love, and having fun doing so. And, you know, it's one of my favorites off the album because sonically, I feel like it really channels people that I love, like Glen Campbell or even Loretta. But the idea is a little more modern, I guess you'd say.
I would have to agree.
Thank you. Well, that's important to me. I mean, if you don't have something to say or somewhat of a point of view, I mean, then what do you have? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of the whole point, you know?
Right. Well, we also want to say congratulations to you on your nomination for Female Vocalist of the Year from the Academy of Country Music.
Thank you. Oh, so crazy. So crazy.
You got some really impressive company there.
I do, yeah.
Miranda Lambert, Martina McBride. Mm-hmm. But I think you sound exactly like Casey Musgraves.
That means a lot to me. I love that compliment, mainly because I just feel like I want to be the first me, not the next anybody else.
Casey Musgraves. Her new album is called Same Trailer, Different Park. This weekend you can listen to every track on the album for free at NPR's exclusive First Listen. Just go to nprmusic.org. Casey, it's really been fun, and it would be fun to catch you in person sometime, and I hope a lot of people can do that.
I would love that. Thank you so much for having me.
Stupid.
For the week ending March the 17th, St. Patrick's Day 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Liz Baker, Amy Held, Lily Percy, and Acacia Squires. Our interns are Annie Russell and Rachel Rood. The technical director is Rob Berman. Mithoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Lydon. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.